So those of you who've seen my talk before, some of this content may be familiar. What I'm trying to do today is sort of have an operations slant, so talk a little bit more about how you design a system that's going to be distributed and work in a sort of dynamic, cloudy environment, and how that relates to our system and how we provision it and so forth. So I tend to think that talks like this work better if people ask questions as I go along. So if you want to ask a question, please come up to the mic at any point, and I'll let you talk. Otherwise, you can save your questions for the end. So my name is Sage Weil. I'm from InkTank, and I'm going to talk about the Ceph distributed storage system. So brief outline of what I'm going to discuss, a little bit of sort of setting the stage about what the sort of system administrator's reality looks like in this day and age. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about Ceph, what it is, what it's used for, how it works, the various ways that you can use it in your architecture. And then towards the end, I'll talk about how you deploy and manage this sort of system. That's, you know, many, many hundreds of thousands of nodes potentially in one seamless cluster. I'll talk a little bit about the roadmap and then a little bit about, you know, why we're open source and why we care about this particular problem project. So the question on everybody's mind should be coming to this talk, why should you care about another storage system? There are many out there. There are many things you can buy. And I think to sort of frame that discussion, I'm going to talk a little about sort of what the reality looks like in the past and what it sort of looks like today. So in the old reality, you had lots of hosts that had direct attached storage, either a direct disk or a RAID array. You'd probably have a whole data center full of these guys. They were a pain to manage. Or maybe you had some network attached storage devices. If you have a few of them, they're the greatest thing ever because it's centralized managed. If you have hundreds and hundreds of them, it's kind of a nightmare. Maybe you are in a larger enterprise and you have an expensive SAN. They're very expensive, but they do some pretty cool things. But these solutions offer some scalable capacity and performance, but only up to a point. They don't tend to scale out across many nodes, at least not in an efficient way. And in, more specifically, they tend to have poor management scalability. You know, managing one filer is great. Managing hundreds is not so much. The other thing that is facing administrators these days are sort of new user demands. So the first thing, obviously, is this whole cloud thing that you might have heard of. And there's sort of, I'm not going to try to tell you what cloud is, but as far as what it translates to for storage developers, it means that you have suddenly many, many disk volumes for all these virtual machines that are sort of automatically provisioned at all times across your system. It also means you tend to have much larger data sets. So this can take the form of RESTful object storage using APIs like S3 or systems like Swift. It might be NoSQL distributed key value stores with tools like Cassandra React. But you're sort of faced with a situation where you have these very big sets of data that you have to manage across lots of servers, which is very different than sort of the traditional problem. There's also this whole big data thing. This is really all about distributed processing and dealing with unstructured data and analytics and so forth. That's also sort of an evolving use case. And suddenly you have somebody who's used to dealing with traditional systems and they have all these other things that they have to deal with as well. At the same time. So when it comes to deploying, sort of designing what your next infrastructure is going to look like, you have a couple of key requirements. First is that you have a number of diverse use cases. You might have object storage that you need to deal with. You might have block devices for virtual machines or legacy machines that are wanting to use iSCSI or something. Many workloads need a shared POSIX file system with coherent caches for multiple hosts. And sometimes you have this structured data problem and you don't actually know what the underlying storage technology really needs. And the other thing that is a requirement is scale. Our systems are getting much larger data sets. You are starting with terabytes and going to petabytes, maybe even to exabytes. You tend to deploy with heterogeneous hardware over extended periods of time. You deploy your first petabyte today, your next one 3 months from now with the next rev of the hardware, something like that. And these systems have to take reliability and fault tolerance into consideration as first principles in the designs. The other problem that administrators face is cost. Ideally, you would like the cost of your storage cluster to be a near linear function of the size or performance that you need. You don't want to pay four times as much for something that's 1.5 times as fast, for example. You also want incremental expansion, so you don't have to sort of take your old system and chuck it out and drop in something that's twice as big and twice as fast in its place. Ideally, you don't want to have vendor lock-in, so the purchasing decision you make for your first petabyte doesn't lock you into the same decision for your second and third petabyte. And what I think this really translates into is a demand for open solutions. You would like something that you can, that is really defined by the software that you run in your storage system and allows you to have freedom of choice in what kind of hardware you deploy underneath it. And the final consideration is time. And this really comes down to ease of administration for you guys. You don't want to have to deal with manual data migration between all these hundreds of different servers or load balancing, moving large home directories between file servers, that sort of thing. You'd like to have painless scaling, so you can have an existing cluster deploy new servers and have it sort of use up all that new storage, or even contract because you have a bunch of old systems that you want to rip out because they're using up too much power, something like that. And having the data seamlessly migrate between those two systems. And sort of in the end, you want something that is going to be DevOps friendly. You know, our whole goal is to sort of automate as much of the system provisioning as possible, and you'd like a system that lets you sort of hook in and tie it in with all the existing tools that they're using or building in order to do that. So Ceph's goal is really to be a good DevOps citizen. We want to have seamless integration with infrastructure tools, you know, things like Chef, Juju, Puppet, Crowbar, whatever homegrown collection of bash scripts that you guys are cooking up. We want to work well with existing tools for solving other problems like statistics aggregation with CollectD, StatsD, Graphite, stuff like that, health monitoring, Nagios, or even just integrating with entire stacks that try to give you a package solution for deploying your own private cloud, that sort of thing. That means we want to have a system that has simple processes for expanding and contracting the cluster, responding to failure scenarios, whether it's the actual peeling or the mop-up that you have after the fact. Which I think in some sense sort of represents the evolution of the Unix philosophy, you know, doing one thing and doing it well. You want a system where the software that you're deploying, everything is just a daemon that's running on some host. You don't have some specialized hardware that you have to deploy with it. You want to have command line interfaces, RESTful APIs, you know, use things like JSON to move data between systems in an easily parsable format, and essentially solve one problem and solve it well, and then sort of interact with a larger ecosystem of tools. So which brings me sort of to the main topic of today. What is Ceph? Ceph is a unified distributed storage system that gives you sort of three key things. First, it gives you object APIs, so you can store objects in a distributed system, either using our native API or using a RESTful API that's compatible with S3 or Swift. It also gives you block storage for storing disk images or LUNs, however you call them, giving you basic features like thin provisioning, snapshots, and copy-on-write clones of images. And finally, it gives you file access for a standard POSIX file access protocol to a shared file system with strong consistency and snapshots. So taking a sort of a broad look at the API stack, you get a picture sort of like this. And I think the key thing to observe here is that the system is based on this red component, the Rados Distributed Object Store, which is the scalable distributed system that underpins all of the Ceph services. So on top of this basic infrastructure, we layer sort of direct APIs to store objects. We layer the S3 compatible RESTful API proxy. We have the virtual disks, and then we have a distributed file system. And all of them sort of share this core distributed component that handles the details of replication, self-healing, self-management, failure detection, healing, that sort of thing. So Ceph is a distributed storage system that's designed to run at data center scale, so anywhere from tens of servers to thousands of servers, or tens of thousands of servers, terabytes to exabytes. It's designed to be fault-tolerant from the ground up, so there's no single point of failure. No one host or one daemon can take the whole system down. And it's also designed to run on commodity hardware, so you can run it on the cheapest white box stuff that you can find, or you can run it on very expensive, higher-end hardware. And again, it's designed to be self-managing and self-healing, because any system at scale is going to have many, many, many moving parts, and you're going to ideally have a small team of administrators that are responsible for managing the whole thing, and you want as much of that process to be automated as possible. So the Ceph distributed object store is based on a basic object model, and the idea here is that you have some number of pools that are just sort of logical collections of data. Each of those pools is sort of an independent namespace and has some basic policy associated with it, like how many replicas of the objects you want to keep and what your policy is for distributing it across storage nodes. And then inside each of those pools, you have bazillions of different objects, where each object is sort of a logical collection of data that's replicated on some number of servers. And objects can store sort of a number of different things. They can have a blob of bytes, sort of like a file, where you're just sort of dumping bytes in them. They can have some attributes associated with them, like extended attributes. And they can also store keys and values. So if you have sort of a record-based collection of data that you want to store in one sort of logical unit, then you can use that part of the interface. So the question at this point that many people have is why are you talking about objects? What are objects and why do I care? The first point is that objects are much more useful abstraction than disk blocks. So you can name an object with sort of an arbitrary alphanumeric string. Objects can have a variable size instead of a fixed size on a logical disk where you have to remember which sector you're actually storing your data with. And because they have this sort of logical encapsulation, you can give them a simple API, but then layer on rich semantics on top of that, like multi-operation transactions on a single object. The other reason is that objects are much more scalable than files. So if you're talking about a directory hierarchy with files and directories, and it's this huge tree structure, it's unclear how to take that directory and distribute it across tens of thousands of nodes. And many operations sort of interact with multiple parts of the tree at the same time, whereas a flat object-based namespace is very easy to distribute, and each operation operates on a single object at a time, which makes it sort of very easy to make a scalable, robust system that uses this simple abstraction. So how do you design a storage system that scales out of these basic pieces? So at a high level, what you basically want is some system that lets a human or non-human interact with some number of disks or SSDs or whatever that are storing some data. And typically, you have some sort of computer in the middle that's sort of arbitrating this access in some way. But in reality, you have more than one person using this, or really, you actually have lots and lots of these guys. And obviously, in this sort of situation, sort of the computer that's arbitrating access from the users to the data can become a single point of failure, can become a performance bottleneck, and you need to make sure that you can, you know, have that not be an issue. So what we really want is something more like this, where we have lots and lots of computers, and whoever is accessing the data can figure out which computer to talk to for which particular piece of data. So what Ceph actually is constructed with is something that looks more like this. So you have some number of disks. On each disk, we use a local file system, something like ButterFS, XFS, X4, because we don't want to reinvent the wheel and re-implement all the file allocation policies and so forth for managing disk blocks. And then on top of each of those file systems, we have a Ceph object storage daemon. And this is sort of the guts of the Ceph system that deals with the details of client access to the data and replication and so forth. And then we have a whole bunch of these typically inside a single host that is, you know, in a single rack. And then you have racks and racks of these servers that make up this larger compute cluster. So there's sort of two pieces of this cluster. The first are a small number of monitor daemons that are responsible for coordinating overall cluster state, you know, which hosts are actually participating in the cluster, what are their current IP addresses, are they up or down, that sort of thing. And these are the guys that sort of maintain basic consensus in this highly distributed, scaled system. But they don't actually store any actual data. They're just sort of managing the basic cluster metadata. And then you have a huge number of these object storage daemons that each of them sitting in front of a disk or SSD, and you know, tens of thousands of them. And they're the ones who are actually storing data on that local device and then serving up that data to clients who are using the system. But the key idea here is that these daemons are intelligent. It's a complicated piece of software that's also dealing with things like replicating data across multiple nodes and migrating data when there's a failure and responding to those sorts of events. So then from the human or non-human's perspective who's actually interacting with this cluster, they just say, I want to store this object with this particular name, and they can sort of treat the cluster as this sort of black box and just sort of, you know, throw it at the client library and it knows which node to talk to and it goes off and often stores it. That's sort of the ideal model that people want to build applications to. The key problem with this system is deciding how are you going to distribute data in such a system. And we have some basic requirements. We want all objects in the system to be replicated some number of times so that if we lose one node, we'll always have backups. But we want those objects to be automatically located, placed, balanced, and even migrated as the cluster state changes over time. So if a node fails, data will move around to make sure there are the right number of replicas, that sort of thing. And finally, we want to make sure that we consider the physical infrastructure. In reality, when we're deploying these systems, you have, you know, some number of Ceph storage daemons and disks in each host. You have a bunch of hosts in a rack. You have multiple racks and rows. You might have multiple rows. You might have multiple data centers even. And you want to be able to specify things like, I want 3 replicas of my data, but I want those replicas to be stored in separate racks or in separate rows or even separate data centers. Or maybe in the same row, but in different racks, depending on what your, you know, bandwidth requirements are or failure tolerance. Is and so forth. So there are essentially 3 basic ways that you can approach this problem. First is have the client essentially give all responsibility to the client. So if I'm going to store a piece of data, I have to choose a server and I store it there and I have to remember where to go to get it. That doesn't work in a dynamic cluster because if I come back a week later, that server might have died and gone away, and my data obviously is no longer to be found. A more common model that many existing systems use is that the user will pick a location to write the data, or the system will at the time that you write it, and then it'll have some big index that essentially says this data is stored over there. And then whenever you want to access that data, you have some lookup request that says, where do I find it? It tells you where you go. You can go and get it. And at least then you have a cluster that can respond to failure, because if you expand it, you can update this use index, and then you can always get to the data that you need. The problem is that index itself becomes very large and becomes a scalability bottleneck as your system grows to hundreds or thousands of nodes or more. And the final sort of approach is to use a special function, a hash-based function, to calculate the location of the data. And this is what the new generation of distributed systems do. You actually just take the current state of the cluster, the name of the object, you do some calculation, and it spits out the answer of what nodes should store your data. And the algorithm that Ceph uses to do this is called CRUSH. The basic idea here is that it's a pseudo-random placement algorithm. It's a fast calculation, so you never have to look up the location of the data. You simply calculate, based on the current state of the system, where your data should be stored. It generates a uniform distribution, so everything's sort of balanced across multiple nodes. And it's a stable mapping, so if you have 100 nodes and a couple of them go down, a small amount of data will have to migrate in order to rebalance everything and recover the data. And the final thing that CRUSH gives you that many other systems do not is that it gives you a rule-based configuration. So you can define essentially a hierarchy of your storage devices, for example, hosts, racks, rows, data centers, and then define some rule-based policy about how you want to distribute your data across that. For example, I might say I want 3 replicas all to be in the same row so that, you know, the replication bandwidth is constrained to a particular switch, for example. But at the same time, I want those replicas to be separated across different racks so that if I lose a single power circuit or somebody with a crash card who bumps into the rack doesn't jiggle more than one set of disks, that sort of thing. And so you can set up these fault domains, and CRUSH will obey those basic policies while also giving you this purely functional calculated placement of your data. So the way this actually works then is you have some cloud of objects, your sort of logical collection of objects in your pool. The system will hash the name of the object into some number of essentially shards. We call them placement groups, or PGs. Each one of those is sort of a logical subset of the overall set of objects. And then we use CRUSH to calculate for each of those placement groups, based on the identifier and the current state of the cluster, which nodes those placement groups should be replicated on. And then once you do that to all of the different placement groups, you get this sort of statistically uniform distribution of data across multiple nodes in the cluster, ideally balanced. The Rados software, then, the Ceph distributed object store, those Ceph OSD daemons that are sitting on those local file systems, are then responsible for actually making sure that distribution is realized. And this has happened in a couple of different ways. First, the Ceph monitor daemons that coordinate all cluster state periodically publish a cluster map that says, what are all the nodes in the cluster? What are their current IP addresses? Are they up or down? What is the CRUSH function that specifies how data should be distributed across those systems? And that sort of allows clients to know where the data should be stored, and also the storage nodes. And then those object storage daemons that are sitting on every node, when they look at these cluster maps, they can say, oh, well, this is where my data should be stored. This is the data that I currently have. It either is in the right place and I need to do nothing and I can start reading and writing from it, or it's in the wrong place and I can coordinate with somebody else to actually move it there. But the key idea is that this is a fully distributed process. Each of these, you have a very loose central coordination that says where data should be stored, and then all of these object storage daemons, you know, tens of thousands of them potentially, are coordinating with each other to make sure the data is actually where you say it should be. And the result then is that you have this very decentralized, very distributed approach that allows massive scales, because you sort of eliminate the central point of coordination that has to tell everyone exactly what to do. They only give you sort of loose specification of where data should be stored in the system. From a client's perspective then, if you need to store an object in this distributed object store, it takes the current copy of the map and just calculates where the data should be stored, and it can go directly to the storage node that stores exactly that data and read and write from it. If you have a problem with your cluster then, for example, if a node fails, again, you have a map update that says this particular node is now down. And in a fully distributed fashion, the other copies of that data will say, oh, I have the copy of the data. I lost one copy. I may need to make a new copy in a new location. And again, in a fully distributed fashion, they can coordinate with the new location. They can sort of in the background be copying all those objects to the new point in the cluster, all in a fully distributed scalable way. And then when the client gets the new version of the map, it can calculate the new location, and it can read and write read and write the data from the appropriate location. So this is sort of the basic foundation that the whole system is based on. You have this massively scalable object store. You can shovel, you know, bazillions of objects in it, and it handles all the details of where the objects should be stored, making sure there are so many copies of it, and then making sure that when you read and write from it, you have this fully consistent view of read after write semantics and so forth, so that you can ignore those details and worry about writing higher level functionality in your storage system. So on top of this basic abstraction, we have a number of different services. There is a Libratus, sort of a low-level library that just lets you sort of use the raw power of the distributed object store. And the basic idea here is you have some web application, say you're making the next version of Flickr or Instagram or something like that, you just have tons of data that you need to shovel into a storage system. So you can link directly into Libratus in your code using the C bindings or the Python bindings or Perl or whatever it is that you're most comfortable with. And then from the application's perspective, it's just storing objects in some cloud. And the Libratus library handles all the native details of contacting the right storage daemon and making sure that your data is written and so forth. And so you can sort of treat the storage cluster as a single logical unit and not worry about all the details. So Libratus gives you direct access to Rados in your applications. You can use a variety of different language bindings. Direct access to storage nodes, so there's no sort of intermediate proxy. The client application will contact directly the network IP address of the storage server in question. Very efficient. So Libratus offers sort of a number of higher level features than just reading and writing objects. And this is where things get interesting. So you can, for example, create atomic single object transactions where you can, for example, send a request that will update both the data portion and the attribute portion of an object in a single transaction that's atomic with respect to other readers or writers. And you can even do things like an atomic compare and swap so that if you would only replace version 2 of the object with version 3, but if it's already changed, then you would do nothing, that sort of thing. You can efficiently store keys and values inside an object if you have sort of a higher level type of data that you're storing, not just blobs of bytes. There is a snapshot infrastructure built into the object store that allows you to have sort of object granularity, snapshot type functionality in the application that you're building on top of this. There's the ability to embed your own code in the object storage daemon. For example, if you're building this new version of Flickr, you might have to filter out RedEye from customer images. You could send a request to the object storage daemon and actually do that RedEye processing on the storage node without copying data over the network using this extensible plugin API that we've created. And you can even use objects as sort of a channel for communication between multiple clients, which is something that we've used in some of our products. But that Libratus gives you sort of this low-level access to the raw power of this distributed object store. That's good for some applications if you're actually building software. For many other use cases, it's not very helpful at all. Rados Gateway is designed with a different use case in mind. It provides a RESTful API that's compatible with Amazon S3 or OpenStack Swift that lets you store objects using HTTP standard protocols in the distributed object store. And the basic idea here is similar. You have some application that's storing objects. Instead of talking directly to the cluster, it talks to this Rados Gateway proxy component, and the gateway then is using Libratus to talk directly to the back-end storage nodes. And the key distinction here is that the application is speaking the RESTful API using HTTP, you can, you know, port 80, you can traverse a firewall, it's compatible, directly compatible with Amazon S3, Swift. And then on the back-end, again, we're using the native Libratus protocols that are distributing all these objects across, you know, thousands of different back-end storage nodes. And Rados gives you a couple of key things. It gives you, you know, a higher level API that supports things like, you know, user buckets. You can have tens of thousands of them or millions or whatever. It gives you all the sort of the accounting features that you need from an object storage service that's going to compete with S3, for example. It lets you do usage accounting and things like that for scraping, for doing all your billing so you can bill your customers. But the key thing is that it's compatible with these standard APIs so that you can take, if you're sort of a hostage to Amazon's infrastructure, you can move it into your own data center. If you're a service provider who wants to compete with Amazon, you can set up a competitive service. If you're building a private cloud service and you just need this sort of RESTful object storage service to build other things, and you can use it there as well. The next piece is the Rados block device. This is, again, sort of a basic service that allows you to create a virtual disk that is striped across many different objects, and those objects are in turn stored in the distributed object store. The use cases here are basically usually for cloud computing. If you have all these virtual machines, they each have virtual disks that they need to be stored somewhere, replicated hopefully reliably, or if you have sort of a legacy SAN type infrastructure and you just want to replace this block level storage with something that's open source, open architecture, then you can do that as well. And the basic idea again is that you have a virtual disk that's broken into all these logical objects, blocks that are stored across many different systems, and that is sort of presented to the computer as a basic block device. In reality, usually this is used for virtualization, so you're actually presenting it to the hypervisor and exposing it to the virtual machine as a raw disk. And again, sort of looking at the same thing, you have all these different objects, all these pieces that are comprising a single image that are assembled, accessed via Libratos, assembled into a single disk image using libRBD, and then presented to a virtualization container like the KVM hypervisor. And then from the VM's perspective, it just sees a disk. It doesn't know that you're actually storing that disk, you know, in little pieces across storage servers that are spread across your network. Of course, because this is shared storage, we can do some fun games. For example, we can take a virtual machine and we can live migrate it between two different hosts, and you can actually do that while the machine is running and online. That always makes for a fun demo. There's also a driver in the upstream mainline Linux kernel that lets you map a RBD virtual disk image as an actual regular block device, like dev RBD0, and presents it to your kernel host. So you can put a file system on it, you can, you know, access it directly via /dev, whatever your use case demands. So Rados block device gives you a disk image that's stored in Rados, decoupling the virtual machine from the host. Images are striped across the entire cluster, not just stored on a single server. So even if you have a very large or very busy image, it's not going to overload one particular node. You can do snapshots on each image. You can do copy and write clones. So for example, if you have a gold operating system install and you're doing a cloud environment, you can make clones of it for each virtual machine without consuming space until you actually write to those clones. And they're supported in a variety of, can be supported in a variety of ways. So there's KVM has native support. It links directly to the RBD library, and you can start up virtual machines that use this infrastructure. It's supporting the mainline Linux kernel. And then a number of cloud computing stacks, like OpenStack and CloudStack, have baked into support into their sort of larger solution. So you can just sort of, you know, click your mouse and create a virtual machine that's backed by Ceph RBD, which is kind of fun. And the final piece is the Ceph distributed file system that sort of rounds out the suite here. And again, the goal is to create a shared distributed file system with files and directories and, you know, normal POSIX semantics that actually scales out across multiple nodes. And the basic picture here is similar to many other sort of object-based file system architectures, if you're familiar. The basic idea is that the client will talk to some number of metadata servers in order to interact with the file system namespace. So in order to list files, traverse directories, look up paths, and so forth, it talks to the metadata server. And then when it comes time to actually read and write file data, it'll talk directly to the storage server storing the object for that actual file content, or that component of the file content. So again, here there's a new class of servers in the system. These are metadata servers. They're responsible for managing the directory hierarchy about metadata for files, for example, the size, owner, timestamps, that sort of thing. These metadata servers actually store all of that metadata in Rados. We've already invented this, you know, scalable, reliable data storage service, so the metadata servers just use that to store the metadata. They're essentially acting as sort of a very intelligent cache or proxy for all the metadata access. The metadata servers don't actually serve any file, so in contrast to legacy protocols like NFS, where you have a server can become a bottleneck, you have multiple metadata servers and only the metadata access is going to them, like open a file, read or write, open a file, rename a file, that sort of thing. But when you're actually reading and write bytes, those go directly to storage nodes. And the basic problem, again, in designing this system is one of how do you distribute the data. Unfortunately, it's a slightly more complicated problem because for a file system, you have a complicated data structure. You have this tree of files and directories that you have to map across multiple servers. And so the question is, you know, how do you do that? And what Ceph does is something a little bit different than many systems. We call it dynamic subtree partitioning, where the system will observe the current workload, what access is actually occurring in the file hierarchy, and it'll sort of dynamically choose subtrees of that hierarchy and migrate them from one metadata server to another. So as you expand the cluster, as you add nodes, as the workload shifts, it'll sort of dynamically carve up these pieces and move metadata around between servers in order to make sure that it's sort of always getting the maximum use out of the existing daemons that are part of the cluster, and also distributing the workload effectively. The Ceph metadata server, because we sort of re-implemented things from the ground up, also does a number of cute things that you don't see in other systems. One of those is what we call recursive accounting. So for every directory in the system, the metadata server is keeping track of recursively all the information that's stored beneath that point in the hierarchy. The most useful piece of information is a summation of file sizes. So for example, normally when you list a directory in a file system, the size that you get for the directory is sort of a meaningless number. You know, an X4, it's like a number of multiple of 4Ks, a number of blocks or something. In Ceph, that number is actually a sum of all the files that are stored in that directory and subdirectories in the entire system. So it's the same thing that you would get effectively from a DU, except that the system is maintaining this sort of in real time, and you get the information for free. You can also, it'll also keep track of other counts, like the number of files stored in a subdirectory and beneath that point in the hierarchy, the most recent modification time, which is useful for like backup applications that need to find out where files have changed. And if you dump the extended attributes on a file, it'll sort of expose these as synthetic attributes, so you can get access to all these counts using interfaces. And the key thing is that it does this in an efficient way. So the cost of sort of propagating this information is amortized over time, and it sort of does it sort of slowly up the hierarchy so that it all works quite well. The other interesting feature is snapshots. So the motivation is that in a very large system, you want to avoid having a petabyte scale file system where you have sort of a single set of snapshots for all data. Doesn't necessarily make any sense, because usually you're storing all kinds of different data in the system. Some of it's logs, some of it's databases, some of it's user home directories. And so we'd like the ability to sort of arbitrarily snapshot any directory in the file system hierarchy at any time. And Ceph does this by creating a simple hidden .snap directory in every directory, very similar to the sort of .snapshot directory that you see with NetApp Waffle. And the idea there is that from the command line using bash or whatever, you can just do a makedir inside that sort of hidden directory, and that will create a snapshot for that subdirectory and everything nested beneath it at that point in the hierarchy. And you have sort of the usual snapshot semantics. You delete a file, it's gone. If you look in the snapshot, it's still there, and you can read it using normal tools. And then when you're done, when you want to remove the snapshot, you just do an armdir, and poof, the thing goes away. And the Ceph metadata server and the OSDs handle all the details of making sure that it's a copy on write copy. It only consumes space once you actually modify the file. And when you remove it, it's all sort of cleaned up in the background. So there are a number of different ways that you can use the Ceph file system, multiple different protocols. So again, there's been a client in the mainline Linux kernel for several years now, so you can just do a mount-t Ceph, and it'll give you sort of a native mount point. You can re-export that as NFS or SIFS if you like. There's a Ceph fuse module, so you can also just run a user space daemon that provides access to the file system. It's slightly less efficient, but it actually does pretty well these days. There's a libcephfs library that's a shared object that you can link directly into your application. So if you don't want to worry about kernel support and you just want to have a file and directory structure for some thing that you're building, you can do that. We've actually used this library to link into Samba's BFS internal abstraction. So you can run a Samba daemon that talks directly to the Ceph backend and re-exports it using SIFS. The same thing with the Ganesha NFS users land server. Does the same thing. It talks to Ceph directly and re-exports as NFS. And we've done the same thing with Hadoop also, which is the sort of distributed MapReduce system. You can run that on top of Ceph instead of on top of HDFS and sort of gain the benefits of having sort of a more real file system that you can mount and manipulate using a standard mount without having to ingest data and so forth. So all of this is interesting if you're interested in Ceph, but what I'd like to talk about today a little bit more is sort of how you go about deploying and managing a system like this. So you have lots of different servers, lots of different daemons, lots of different moving parts, and ideally you'd like to have sort of a very small number of system administrators that are administering all these servers. And I've broken this down into a couple of different categories. So the first thing you want to do is make sure that installation is very easy. And so one of the things that Ceph has done is try to work very closely with distributions to make sure that we've built packages for Debian, Fedora, Ubuntu, OpenSUSE, all the different sort of variations of Linux that people are running on their systems. And so ideally when you're going to install the system, it's as easy as updating your Yum sources, your Debian sources, and running apt-get install or whatever the equivalent is for your particular system. Another thing that's important, particularly for a scalable distributed system, is that the system is able to cope with running mixed software versions. So if you have 1,000 servers and you're running version 1.0 and you want to upgrade to version 1.1, you can't upgrade them all at the same time. You can't take the system offline because you're running a critical web application that can't tolerate any downtime. And so we built in support in the system so that we can automatically make sure that we understand the features that are supported by the current node and the remote node, and we'll adjust the data that we send over the wire appropriately so you can sort of upgrade each node at a time, each daemon at a time, and the system will be continuously available as you go through that process. And finally, we want to make sure that we sort of facilitate the bleeding edge and testing and so forth. So we've created an automatic build system that such that for every branch that we push into Git, every particular feature or bug fix that we're testing is automatically built on all these distributions, and people can actually install those packages very easily on their system. So if there's somebody that wants to test a new version, they can do that very easily. If there's somebody that's running an existing stable version and we need to get a bug fix out to them very easily, we can simply push a branch and then their continuous integration system or whatever can pick it up and distribute it across all those servers. The next sort of issue is configuration. One of our goals is to minimize the amount of local configuration that users have to do on every node that's participating in your cluster. So for example, the Ceph configurations files deal with things like where the logs go, what the local data paths are that we're actually serving, what the tuning options are, how many threads we're dedicating to this particular part of the server. And at the same time, we want to make sure that all the sort of cluster state about which daemons are actually participating, how our data is distributed, all that is managed in a sort of more controlled, coherent way by the Ceph monitor daemons. So you can't actually misconfigure that. The system is sort of managing that in a much more controlled, central way. So when you're starting up daemons, you can specify config options in a number of different ways. You can put them in a configuration file. You can specify them on the command line. You can even have a running daemon and inject configuration options without restarting it if you want to change debugging levels or inspect state, that sort of thing. And then we have a number of different configuration management options. So, the goal here is to facilitate lots of different types of users. Some people have sort of a static cluster that's very small. Other people have a very large dynamic cluster has their own homebrew automation scripts. So we want to make sure we can support either a single configuration file that describes the entire cluster and is sort of synced to all nodes, or we can support situations where you're sort of generating config files on demand using tools like Chef or Juju, Crowbar, that sort of thing. Or even just have a very minimal configuration file that just says these are the monitors and everything else is using the defaults. And the key goal here, again, is to be flexible. There's no one size that fits all types of deployments, and we want to make sure that we can support all these different types of users. One of the key challenges, then, in a large system is provisioning. We want to, first and foremost, we want to embrace the dynamic nature of these types of systems. So you have disks, you have hosts, you have racks. They can come online and be added to the cluster at any time. You can have nodes that will fail at any time. You can have network switches that go down. Software might be upgraded. All kinds of things can happen. So the system has to be able to cope with sort of this constantly changing dynamic environment. And so as building blocks to sort of allow us to deal with this, we focus on having simple scriptable sequences. So for example, to add a new storage daemon to the system, you allocate a new identifier using one command. You initialize the local data directory, and then you start it up, and it'll join the cluster. And this can happen on many different nodes in parallel in a totally distributed and safe way. And at the same time, there could be a failure, and we want to make sure that the system will sort of support these types of processes. We also want to sort of identify the minimal amount of central coordination that's necessary to prevent chaos. So for example, because the Ceph monitors are sort of handling the key cluster state as far as who's participating and who is not, there are a few minimal parameters they have to specify as far as these are the members that have to be present in order to have sort of a quorum, for example. And so that's the amount of information that people would have to sort of specify a priori when they're doing their Chef configuration, for example. And then everything else can be totally dynamic and rule-based and scripted and so forth. The end goal then is to provide all the basic hooks that we need in sort of the core Ceph software that'll support integration with all these different types of tools. So whether you're using your homebrew stuff, you're using Chef Juju, we just sort of have the hooks to let them do all the little pieces that they need to in order to build up this highly scalable system. This type of system also represents sort of a new paradigm as far as dealing with high availability. So in sort of the traditional old school page view of things, the typical model was you would deploy a pair of servers. There would be some heartbeat between them. You'd probably have some floating IP address that is migrated dynamically between them. And then when the client is contacting the server, it's actually contacting one of these two machines, and you don't really necessarily know which it is. The fundamental problem with this sort of architecture is that it's cumbersome to configure, it's hard to deploy, and essentially the client-server model that it's based on doesn't actually scale. The client thinks it's talking to one server, and the protocol that it's speaking with that server is sort of totally unaware that actually you want to scale out and not up. And so what we want to do is make sure that the software is designed in a way that makes the client protocol actually cluster aware. The client knows that it's talking to lots of different servers. So that means that the clients, when they're interacting with the system, they need to learn the topology of the distributed cluster. So when they authenticate and they get sort of these cluster maps, they know all the OSDs, they know their current IPs and ports, and they know the distribution policy that says how data is distributed across all of these different nodes. And then when the clients need to read or write data, they simply choose which node they need to talk to for that particular object, and they can talk directly to that node in a totally scalable fashion without having any sort of bottlenecks or proxies or gateways that understand where data should go. That means that when servers start up, they can dynamically register with the cluster. So instead of having a static configuration of which nodes are participating, as the system comes up, it'll register with the monitor. It says, this is the current IP address that I'm using. This is the random port that I bound to. You can publish this in a new map so that clients can now discover that I'm available and I'm storing this data. And then those new cluster maps that tell you who is all currently online and what their current status is are distributed via gossip in sort of an efficient distributed way so that everybody finds out how to find their data. The servers then become responsible for managing this heartbeat and replication logic that used to be sort of on the system administrator's shoulders. So instead of having a fragile configuration or these failover pairs, the system design itself understands that all data should be replicated across end nodes. We have this complicated distribution function that specifies how that should happen, and then all this code that deals with making sure that data is actually moved to the right location when there's a failure and so forth. And then the client just needs to know which data it needs, which storage server it needs to talk to using those maps, and everything is sort of hidden from the higher level parts of the system. Sort of an example of how we sort of use this in practice is the infrastructure that we're using for managing disks in the sort of newer versions of the software. And this is a little bit different than sort of the traditional way of saying, you know, this storage server is this number and using this particular path mounted in this location. So the basic idea is that when you sort of put a disk into the system, we use a GPT partition label with sort of a specific UUID tag that says this particular disk is, you know, for storing Ceph object data. And then when you insert that disk or when you boot the machine up, UDEV generates an event that says, you know, this disk is now online. There's a rule in there that'll kick off and it'll run this Ceph disk activate script. And the activate script will basically mount that disk in a temporary location. It'll say, oh, this disk belongs to this cluster, it's this number ID. I'll mount, bind, move that to the correct directory so it's in the right location and available for use. And then I'll kick off another event that says, okay, start the daemon for that particular node. It'll even adjust the cluster metadata about where that disk is located. So for example, in Ceph, every OSD, it lives in the hierarchy, the crush hierarchy, you know, a particular host, a particular rack, a particular row. And so this script will say, oh, well, this disk, you know, maybe it used to be in this host, but that host crashed and I ripped it out and I pulled the disk and I plugged it into a different host. This automated process will come up and it'll say, oh, this disk is now located here. It'll update the cluster's notion of where that disk is located so that it can make sure that data gets migrated to the right locations. And then finally, it'll trigger the upstart or sys via init or whatever script that'll actually start the daemon. The daemon will start up. It'll say, here's my new IP address. I'm part of the cluster, and then life will continue. And the key goal here is that we don't want to have any manual node per node configuration on the system. So ideally in this model, we would literally have, you know, a stack of new disks that we got from the manufacturer. We'd tag each one that says, you know, this is a disk that's available to be consumed by Ceph by writing some particular UID partition thing. And then you just sort of plug them into servers. The servers would identify the disk, add it to the cluster, and make that storage available. And then if the host fails, you can just rip out the disk and put in another one. And if you choose, it'll just sort of magically come back up to sort of minimize the operator intervention in this sort of case. One of the other key problems that you have to deal with in these sorts of systems is managing the health of the system. So again, we have these Ceph monitors that are dealing with sort of the core cluster state, you know, which nodes are participating and so forth. And they're there to aggregate basic system health state as well. So, you know, they know which daemons are up and down, they know their current IP addresses. They also keep track of the disk utilization on each of those storage nodes, so they can give you sort of a summation total when you do a DF that sort of thing. And then we have these very simple hooks that will query the system health. So for example, there's a ceph health command that'll give you sort of a one line, you know, health okay or health warning, and you know, two disks offline and this recovery is happening, like a high level summary, or a much more detailed dump of all the current issues that the monitor identifies. And then you can write very trivial plugins for tools like Nagios so that you know, every 10 seconds you'll query the cluster, and if it says that there's something wrong, you know, your pager will go off or whatever it is that you want in your particular environment. One of the other things we built in is a basic daemon instrumentation. So internally in the code, we keep track of lots of internal statistics about how many requests we're serving, how many bytes we've read and written, how much memory we're using, that sort of thing. And we created a sort of a simple interface so that we can query the state of a running daemon to dump all these statistics out. And then because in this sort of ecosystem, we don't want to have to reinvent the wheel every time we have some new functionality, we hook into external tools in order to aggregate that information. So for example, there's a plugin for Collecti, which is a common statistics usage information gathering tool that'll dump that information from every daemon, and then it'll aggregate it to, you know, however you configure Collecti to some central storage system. At Dreamhost, we use Graphite, for example, so we can make these nice graphs very easily. StatsD is a popular tool that came out of Etsy, for example. And you can use these things to monitor overall performance for the system. The end result then is that there are many sort of paths to setting up these sorts of systems. So in Ceph's case, you can do it all yourself. You can use all these sort of low-level hooks that we built into the system for initializing new daemons, for starting them and stopping them and so forth. So you can use those interfaces directly. There's Ceph scripts. Ceph is a relatively popular these days. We have sort of our own version of the cookbooks that we use and publish. Dreamhost has published the ones that they're using for their new cloud products. There's a number of cookbooks that are designed specifically for use with Dell's Crowbar product, which is useful if you're a Dell customer. Canonical's Juju is more interested in sort of service orchestration as opposed to just configuration management. And there are a number of Juju charms, they call them, that deal with automatically provisioning new Ceph daemons and starting them up and so forth. And then there are a number of prepackaged solutions. So there are other companies that are building, you know, an entire appliance or stack that uses Ceph as sort of one component. So, you know, Piston is selling an OpenStack-based appliance that uses Ceph, for example. There's a Delk solution using Crowbar, SUSE's Cloud, and so forth. So a little bit about the Ceph project status and roadmap. So as you know, there are a number of different components of Ceph. There's sort of the low-level object store, there's the low-level Rados API, the RESTful object storage, and the block device. In my opinion, those are all pretty awesome. People are using them today in production and are very happy with the results. The file system is not quite as awesome as the rest of the system. It's not so much that the features aren't there, but that it hasn't sort of had the dedicated sort of vindictive quality assurance that it needs in order to be something that you can trust your data to in an online environment. So that's a work in progress. Sort of a current status of the project. There was an Argonaut release, a stable release that we put out over the summer, version 0448, that had stable support for Rados, for the block device, and for the Rados gateway. This is what most current users are using. There's a Bobtail stable release, which is sort of the next iteration that's about to be released this week, actually. It has a number of new features. RBD cloning is one that lets you sort of create a copy and write image of a disk, a virtual disk. Much improved performance, better scaling performance and behavior as you reach, you know, thousands of OSDs, better failure management and so forth. The Rados gateway has matured significantly as far as its coverage of APIs, both on the Swift side and on the Amazon S3 side. Performance improvements there, and it's due out any day now, as soon as we fix those last few bugs. The next stable release after that is going to be called Cuttlefish. If you haven't figured it out yet, we're naming these versions after cephalopods because they're cool and have many arms. And the sort of the key thing here is that we're shifting our engineering focus from sort of the low-level components that we've spent the last year stabilizing to the file system, which is sort of, in our opinion, sort of the most exciting part. So there's a pivot in engineering. One of the things that we're working on is better integration with Samba, so you can re-export the Ceph file system with SIFS. Better NFS support, both in Linux kernel and with NFS Ganesha, making sure that the Hadoop option is sort of fully packaged and tested and all that stuff and so forth, so people can actually use it very easily. On the Rados block device side, There are people working on integration with Xen. So right now, KVM is the only hypervisor that sort of natively will re-export a Ceph RBD image to a virtual machine. If you're using another hypervisor, you have to use the kernel block device and then put it on top. But Xen has its own sort of internal API called BlockTap that will expose block devices. So we want to do that integration. And also be able to create sort of an iSCSI daemon that will re-export RBD using that standard protocol for those environments. The Rados gateway is maturing sort of beyond sort of a single site installation. So the next version will support multi-site federation. So you can have sort of a global namespace of buckets, but buckets can exist in different data centers and be replicated across data centers. So you know you'd have a backup in a different state in case there's an earthquake or flood or something like that. And then on the Rados side, on this low-level object store side, we're again working on geo-replication, disaster recovery, and ongoing performance improvements to make sure that we sort of keep up with the latest generations of hardware. Ceph, as a general rule, aims to be hardware agnostic. You can run it on very slow SATA disks, on SAS, on SSDs, or even on Fusion IO, something high-end flash, PCIX type cards. And it's mostly concerned about the problem of distributing data across lots of nodes and not sort of the internal details of how that data is stored locally. But we want to make sure that we take advantage of those different types of storage whenever appropriate. So I'm going to seg slightly and talk a little bit about why we actually work on Ceph and why we think this is important. The first reason is that there are limited options for open source storage, particularly scale-out storage. So there are projects like Gluster and Lustre and in the HPC space, PVFS and so forth. But it's a very short, small menu in relation to the number of commercial products that are out there. And those proprietary solutions tend to be very expensive. They tend to not actually scale all that well, either well at all or specifically scale it out to many, many, many servers. And more importantly, they always tend to marry hardware with software. So you have to go to some particular vendor and buy a specific box running a specific version of their software, and it's buying their support, and it's, very expensive and the freedom that people have become accustomed to. And as a result, users are hungry for alternatives. They want scalability, they want to bring down their costs so they can run, they can choose the quality of hardware that they run on. They want, many of the same features, they want different features. But more importantly, they want open solutions that are interoperable. So, they're building entire stacks for running, cloud computing and so forth, and they want to be able to integrate that storage natively into their system. And if it's open source, then they can, build those APIs and do all that work themselves without having to, negotiate with some technical salesperson at a large organization. Which brings me to licensing, which for many of you may be very boring. But I wanted to make a few points. One is that we chose the open source license for Ceph with a few basic goals in mind. We want to be able to promote adoption so that everyone can use Ceph, be it a school lab in Indonesia all the way to New York Stock Exchange. We want everyone to be able to use Ceph without paying for it necessarily. We want to enable community development so that people can contribute to the project. We want to prevent Ceph from becoming proprietary because we think that, because we're idealists, I suppose. But we also want to allow organic commercialization. So we want people to be able to build commercial products that use Ceph without necessarily being beholden to talking to one organization to license the code, for example. So we want to develop this sort of rich ecosystem. And for that reason, we chose the LGPL2 license. It's copyleft. That means that if you change Ceph itself and you include it in your product, you have to share your source code. That's sort of the idealistic part. But at the same time, it's okay to link it to proprietary code. So you can have this, this very complicated proprietary product with all sorts of secret sauce. And even if you use Ceph as a storage layer in there, as long as you share just the changes to Ceph itself, everything else is sort of unaffected by that license. We also allow a fragmented copyright. We don't require copyright assignment from contributors. So there's no single person or entity that owns all the Ceph source code or could potentially change that license. And in turn, that leads to a very strong community. It means that there are many players that are involved and invested in the project. And there's no sort of single business whose success or failure would determine the fate of the project as well. So we think that's very important because Ceph, as a system, is an ingredient in a much larger ecosystem. You guys are building entire data centers, running, huge services, and storage is just one piece of that larger picture. And we need to sort of play well within that ecosystem. And building both a viable user community and developer community and business community, all those things are going to be important for and success. And finally, we believe that truly open source solutions are disruptive. So it means that there's frictionless integration with other projects. There's freedom to innovate on protocols, so we're not stuck with things like NFS. We can do something better, which is nice. We can leverage community testing, development resources. And in the end, we really just think that open development is a more efficient way to build better technology. So very briefly, who we are. Ceph originated in a research group at the University of Santa Cruz. Too long ago for me to really talk about comfortably. For several years, it was development was supported by DreamHost. Most recently, InkTank was spun off of DreamHost with the goal of supporting Ceph as an open source project and providing sort of a business entity that you could purchase real support and warranties and so forth from. And finally, there's a growing user and development community, both in the Linux distros and the user base. All the cloud computing people are very excited about Ceph. And then people, system integrators, OEMs, and so forth, who are looking at using Ceph in their next generation products. So that's everything I have. Thank you very much. So feel free to come up if you want to ask questions. You should use the microphones. And they asked me also to identify who you are, because they're going to include all these questions and so forth in the proceedings.
Yep. Yeah, I'm Dave Rocks from Pandora Radio. I was just curious, you were talking about the crush algorithm that's used to determine the location to place the data as well as retrieve the data. Mm-hmm. And so it's functional and that it operates deterministically without a lookup. But two slides previous to that, you're talking about encouraging heterogeneous systems and whatnot. How mm-hmm. do you account for varying latencies, speeds, write-through performance, retrieval performance in the crush algorithm? If I say that I need 6 replicas, but 3 of my boxes are far slower than the other 3, how does it know to fetch it from the faster ones when possible? And the inverse is true. Yeah. How do I guarantee write consistency and say that maybe the slower boxes are the more reliable ones, and I want to guarantee that, or when I commit a write, how do I know that it's actually hit the right number of blocks?
So there are several questions there and several answers. The first answer is that crush allows you to weight your devices. So you can say this device is twice as fast, it gets twice as much data, and therefore twice as much I/O. The second answer is that you actually can create multiple pools of objects in your system. So you might create one crush hierarchy that has all of your very fast devices that are SSDs, that's sort of your nearline storage pool, and then create a Rados pool of objects that's stored just on those devices, and then you can create a slower pool that's on your SATA devices. You can also use crush to create a rule that says, I want the first replica to be on a fast device, and the second and third replicas to be on a slow device. So all the reads and writes go to the fast machine, and then only the writes are bled off to the other ones. The question about write consistency, that's actually not a crush problem per se. Crush just decides where your data should be stored. And it's actually the system that we build on top of that, the Rados Distributed Object Store, that's responsible for making sure that all your replicas are up to date. And that's actually one of the reasons why we have the architecture we do, where the client will send the write once to the primary replica, and it's responsible for serializing the writes and making sure it's appropriately versioned and committed atomically to all the different replicas. And it's then responsible for making sure that everything is consistent and safe. And the basic model is that a write will be acknowledged to the client only after it's hit all replicas, all in replicas. So if you have 3 extra replication, it writes to all 3 before you get an ACT. And sort of the final question, actually, I think where your question started, is how do you deal with varying performance and load balancing and so forth? And the answer there is that there's no easy answer. If you have 100 nodes and you're distributing data across them and one of them is slow, at some point you need to identify that node needs to get less traffic and be weighted appropriately. So in Ceph, we provide all the tools to adjust those weights, but we don't yet automatically detect the performance invariance and sort of magically deal with that. That's sort of the layer of automation that we haven't yet built. But given the tools that we do provide, as far as exposing statistics and so forth, we'd like to think that people can build those things on top.
Andrew Hume from AT&T Labs. Talk about data integrity. Where do you detect errors? Where do you report those errors? Mm-hmm. What checksumming is involved? Mm-hmm. Yada, yada.
So there are, again, a number of different answers. So the first The first piece is that whenever we're sending data over the wire, we always generate a checksum and validate that checksum on the other side, because the TCP checksums are only 16 bits and they actually are wrong very frequently. Whenever we write data to disk, our sort of goal for the future is to use Butterfs wherever possible, because Butterfs integrates checksums into all layers of the file system, and whenever you read data, all of its checksums are verified, so you always know that you're getting the right bits, modulo any bugs at least. And so that's always there. But I guess the larger answer is that Ceph has a background scrub process that will periodically, for every placement group, every some configurable amount of time goes by, it'll look at all the objects that it currently stores in both replicas, and then it'll compare the result and make sure that you have the same objects on both nodes. And it'll even read back that data over some larger configurable interval to make sure that you don't have any latent disk errors that have grown. And then compare the checksums to make sure it's actually the same bits that are stored on both replicas, and so that you have the full answer. Now, the far future, the ideal goal is that you have sort of end-to-end checksumming all the way from the client application all the way down to the disk. And there are a number of standards that are and APIs that are sort of in progress. There's this SCSI diff-dix thing that you can use if you use a very specific set of Linux kernel APIs. What we're sort of doing is waiting until those APIs mature a little bit, or it's more clear how to really use them appropriately, so that when the client writes data into its page cache, at that point, the checksum is calculated, or even by the client application itself, and then that checksum is passed all the way across all these sort of pieces, across the wire, across replicas, and then passed into the file system and verified. And we're not there yet, but that's where we would like to get. Yeah.
John Carota, UC Berkeley.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could comment on the advancement you're most proud of since the OSDI paper in 2006. In particular, I was kind of interested in the work you were alluding to in dynamic re-replication based upon read demand in the OSDs.
Is that something I talked about in the OSDI paper?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that was a long time ago. That is actually something that we looked at and didn't end up doing because it wasn't as easy as we sort of hoped it would be. There have been a number of different things that we've investigated and not done. For example, one thing that we looked at was the idea of having, you know, if all your reads are going to the primary replica and their replica's overloaded, we would shed some of that read workload over to other replicas. And those end up being actually very hard problems to solve because of the actual numbers involved. But many things have happened to the project since then. So the security framework has evolved to include a security framework that looks very much like Kerberos, for example. So you have mutual authentication between clients and servers. The metadata server architecture has improved to have this recursive statistics, for example, which is very fun to show system administrators who are used to trying to figure out where all their disk is being used up. I think the one that I like the most is the flexible snapshot architecture on the metadata server. So for any directory, you can create a snapshot, and you can access it using generic tools. And it ends up being very complicated to implement, but once it works, it's pretty fun. So, yeah.
I'm Deke Klinger from Qualcomm.
Hey.
When you say that the POSIX file system is nearly awesome,
nearly awesome.
You quantify nearly and give any sense of roadmap for removing that qualifier?
Yes. So in reality, the metadata server code has been largely static for the last 1 to 2 years even. Most of the feature set that is included in that part of the system was developed a long time ago. You know, the subtree partitioning, the snapshots, and the recursive statistics. Most of our focus over the last year or so has been just on the lower levels. So it's not that it's unstable, it's just that it's not well tested. So some people have been using it, and it's been fine. The basic rules of thumb currently are that if you use a single metadata server and don't get too carried away with lots of snapshots, then you're in pretty good shape. Our goal right now as we sort of pivot focus is that for the next release, we'll have either a fully robust and stable system that where we torture all the failure paths and so forth for a single metadata server or for the clustered metadata. And the only question there is whether we'll get as far when we're exercising all the failure paths, because as soon as you have, you know, 10 different servers and they're failing in different orders at different points, then there's a sort of a combinatorial effect on the different possible recovery paths, and we need to make sure we exercise all those before you can sort of trust it. So that's our goal, that's what we're aiming for. But the time frame for the Cuttlefish is, you know, quarter two probably next year is sort of what we're aiming for. So we'll see. It always looks, you know, just right over the horizon, and it's always very hard to predict these things.
Yeah. Carson Gaspar from Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. These snapshots anywhere you want them using simple tools are really, really great. And how do I know where the hell they're hiding so I can find out what's pinning all my data and using all my space?
So there's this recursive statistics thing. So if you dump the xadders on a directory, you can see how many files and bytes are stored beneath that point. One of those numbers is how many snapshot, they're called realms, but regions of the tree that have some set of snapshots on them. And so if you look at the directories, the current directory, you can tell if they're nested ones, and then you sort of do a search, a guided search.
Can you tell how much space that snapshot is pinning?
Unfortunately, no.
And that same question goes for cloned block devices. And
Yeah. So currently you can't track that information. So all the copy and write stuff is hidden beneath several layers, and it's all done. But the general model for these types of systems is that everything is sort of thinly provisioned, and then as you get close to full, you just add more nodes. You don't delete data.
This is a more of a billing kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah.
The other question is, I know this is future work for you guys. Have you thought of doing something similar to the multi-tiered caching that ZFS or something like that does, where you sort of HSM-ish?
Yeah. So there are sort of two avenues that we'd like to attack that from. One is by sort of integrating tiering into individual storage nodes. So, you know, Ceph is hardware agnostic. It just sits on the file system, and the file system could be on whatever. So file systems like ButterFS or even disk arrays and software bits in Linux will handle combining SSDs and disks and moving hot and cold data around. That support isn't in ButterFS, but that's one of the things that will be there soon, hopefully, because everybody wants it. So that's one answer to the question. The other answer is that ideally, in the larger Ceph system, you would have different pools of storage that are, you know, slow servers with slow disks and fast servers with fast disks, and you would migrate cold data to the sort of more archival stuff. And our goal is to have sort of a larger infrastructure in the metadata server that will allow that type of migration, and then it would deal with both with things like, if we implement parity encoding in the future, it would be part of that solution. If we do data deduplication, where we're doing content addressable storage, it would be integrated within that framework. And so sort of all those things would be part of the same infrastructure, but that's much farther down the roadmap, so, you know, 2014 probably.
I think you almost just now answered my question. I'm looking for reliability, warm and fuzzies from you. Should we interpret the release number as a measure of your warm and fuzziness?
No, that's mostly my ego, actually.
Okay.
So we're talking a lot about the file system.
Forget the file system.
Okay.
What about everything else? Rados? If we were to try to run, say, virtual machines on top of, you seem more comfortable with KVM at this point.
Yes, that's what most users are deploying. So people are deploying Rados behind their own web applications. They're using RBD in their cloud deployments, and they're using the Rados Gateway for object storage. And all three of those solutions are being deployed by people currently in production successfully.
What?
And they tend to be happy. And those are the things that we test.
So I'm trying to figure, are we at the stage yet where a Goldman or a Morgan Stanley might be reasonable to start swapping something like this in for the AFS infrastructure, or would you be more comfortable with a couple more years of development first?
I think more time always means more comfort.
Oh, yeah,
but
sure.
That has nothing to do with whether or not it's sufficient comfort now. And I think that it largely, what I usually tell people when they ask me this question is that production ready isn't a binary term. It's, you know, it depends on what kind of data you're storing in it. If it's like the crown jewels, then maybe you want to use something where the code hasn't been touched in 10 years, like AFS perhaps. But depending on your deployments, then there are many other options. So there are organizations like Morgan Stanley who are evaluating Ceph right now. I can tell you that much. And I would definitely suggest that you take a look.
Matthew Barr, Snap Interactive. One thing I didn't note was, because you don't have a list of masters or things like that, how do you do discovery, especially if, you know, systems can go up and down? How do you find the actual contents of the actual nodes?
Yes. There's only one part of the system that has a fixed IP address, and that's the monitor cluster. They run Paxos internally, so there's normally an odd number of them, like 3 or 5. And in order to talk to the cluster, you need to know at least one of their IP addresses so you can discover the other ones. And that's how discovery normally works. What we recommend people do is that they either just put that in their configuration file that's on every node, or they set up a DNS record that has multiple A records for all the monitors. Once you discover one monitor, you get the current set of all of them, and so you only need one. But if you only give one and that one happens to be down, then you're out of luck. So you want a bunch of them. And everything else is dynamically registered through the monitor. So it stores the master copy of the crush map, your policies, and the OSDs registered through there. Yeah.
And just because I'm guessing everyone else is going to think of this question, at what point VMware comes into the picture?
VMware?
And iSCSI, I guess, would be the optimal for that?
I know very little about VMware
because
it's a closed system. There's only so much you can learn, and you have to be interested. The current answer is probably iSCSI. So that's one of the reasons why iSCSI is on the roadmap for the next release, just to ease integration into existing environments where people want to replace some existing infrastructure and they don't want to change anything else. I imagine there is a better solution if you sort of get deeper into the guts of VMware, but that's really up to VMware. So,
NFS and iSCSI perfectly happily.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Hi, my name is John Looney from Google. I run storage for a few years, and this is the first distributed file system I've seen that doesn't look like a clone of the 8 or 10 year old version of GFS. It's quite exciting. One comment, by the way, when people say, "Is it production ready?" Mm-hmm. The general thing we used to say for GFS when people said, "Is it ready for us?" It was like, well. Other people say it's production ready for their use cases. I'm sure you'll discover what your use case is as soon as you start using it, because every file system has bugs for everyone. So what's the difference between HDA and the other drives? You seem to say that you could attach HDB, HDC, etc., and just partition them and make them go. Does it treat HDA, the boot disk, differently?
That part of the system is a bunch of scripts to automate the provisioning of disks. It only kicks in if there's a specific GPT partition label UUID type on the partition. So you label disks as, this is a Ceph disk that's ready to be used, or this is a Ceph disk that's being used. And if that specific tag pops up, then it gets used up. Mm-hmm. So it won't magically consume disks until you actually
I was just thinking maybe it would a better, a useful deployment be that it would netboot in order to detect boot disks?
That is a perfectly valid way to do it, and I'm sure lots of people want to do that,
What happens when one of the metadata nodes dies? These are the ones that look after a subtree. How quickly does it take another node to take over?
Yeah, so the metadata servers have stateful sessions with the clients. They have all this locking and leasing, and they're sharing caches with the other metadata servers. But every modification, they're writing to a journal, and that journal is stored in Rados objects in the distributed object store. So if the daemon crashes, a new one will take over. It'll replay its journal to recover all the critical state. It'll reconnect to the peers to reestablish the shared cache state, and then it'll continue.
But it's the order of minutes?
Oh, no. It seconds.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it really depends on how big your journal is, how much state it is, and how fast your processor is.
What happens when you add a rack of empty machines?
Then if they all get added
In one go,
then they'll all get added to the crush map. A whole bunch of placement groups will get the recalculation will include all those new nodes. Many of those new nodes will be replicas, and so the existing two replicas, say if you're doing 3x replication, the existing two will continue to process reads and writes, and in the background they'll stream all the contents for that placement group off to the new disk. Then once it's ready, they'll also get writes. In some cases, the primer will be allocated on the new rack, but the new rack has no data, and so it'll temporarily remap that placement group and the crush map so that the primer is on an old node, so that it again goes through the same process and then simplify.
Sure.
And there's one of the things that the new release Bobtail that's coming out does is it adds a lot of reservation and scheduling to minimize the sort of performance impact that has. So in the older versions, the system was sort of get kind of slow in that when you're sort of adding a whole bunch of stuff, and the new version is much, much, much better.
Cool. Thank you very much. I'm very excited.
Thanks.
Marcia Getch, Brigham Women's Hospital. Are you thinking at all about encryption?
Yes. So the current security authentication authorization framework, it's basically a version, looks just like Kerberos, except it's distributed. And so all the authentication stuff that goes over the wire is authenticated, but none of the actual user data is. One type of encryption that people might want is to actually encrypt data that goes over the wire. We actually haven't had all that much demand for it, although in theory, we have all the keys to actually do it. We just don't do the actual encryption, so it'd be very easy. That'd be a very easy thing to add. But most people don't want that because usually they're running Ceph within a single data center and they're not too worried about people sniffing traffic. What's more often a concern is on-disk encryption, at-rest encryption. And the concern there is that if you have a bunch of disks and they fail, you can't throw them away because there might be some customer data that someone will pull off if they grab it out of the dumpster, or you can't RMA the disk or whatever it is. And so that's actually the thing that we're going to tackle first. And the solution there is actually just going to be some integration with the startup scripts to slip dmcrypt on the disk and escrow the keys inside the Ceph monitor so that it's sort of seamless. Anything else? One more. You're back.
Please, God, don't do it that way. Please actually understand the encryption and don't outsource it to something so you can do useful stuff like have you don't know the keys to the data, the client
yes.
knows the
so
keys.
That's, I understand that, and that's actually why we haven't done encryption up till now. That is technically the right way where the user has the keys and doesn't provide it to the system. But it turns out there are many use cases where actually that's not actually the concern. It's not the customer that wants to encrypt the data. It's just the service provider who wants to limit their liability so they can throw away the disks.
But
and so this is a very easy thing that they can just
do. It yourself. Don't use dmcrypt, please. Please don't.
No. Are there specific issues with dmcrypt, or is it just...
There have been many, and... Okay. Doing proper key escrow and stuff and all the other features of management are just easier if you don't outsource that piece of it.
Well, the key escrow we would be doing in this case, right? We're storing the keys. We're just not re-implementing, but okay, we'll talk about it offline. Yeah. All right. Anything else? Thank you, everybody, for your time. Thank you.